This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Police body and dash cameras were touted as something that would bring greater transparency to police operations, particularly in their interactions with citizens. But as we found out in the case of the shooting by police of Keith Smith, those cameras tell only part of the story. The video they produce aren't carefully orchestrated like a Hollywood movie. They show, sometimes in primitive detail, only one part of an unfolding drama. Despite that, the public wants to see that footage. In this age of increasing distrust of authority, particularly by African Americans of police, those videos provide not only the possibility of greater transparency, but the potential of diffusing a volatile situation. Yet over the weekend, North Carolina added a new wrinkle. On Saturday, a law went into effect that mandates a court order to release any of those videos in the future. Even the police must turn to the courts for permission to release them. Depending on your point of view, this decreases transparency by putting up another roadblock or takes the decision-making away from politicians and places it in the hands of the judiciary. Today, we look at this technology and how it's being used here and in other parts of the country and its impact, positive and negative, on police operations and public safety. We're joined by Julie Eisel, chair of the Community Safety Committee and a member of Charlotte City Council. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you.
Nice to have you here. She's in our studio, and joining us from NPR is Nancy Lavine, director of the Urban Institute's Justice Policy Center, whose aim is, in their words, to put objective research findings into the hands of policymakers and practitioners so they can make sound decisions about how to best improve public safety. Nancy, thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Seth Stoughton is an assistant professor of law at the University of South Carolina School of Law, where he focuses on the regulation of police. Incidentally, he was also an officer in the Tallahassee Police Department for 5 years, and he is with us by phone. Good morning, Seth.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Let me begin with you, Julie Eisel. When did Charlotte first begin to use body and or dash cameras?
I can't speak to when we first started using dash cameras, because I think those have been in existence pretty long, but body cameras started in 2015.
Okay. And you say that Charlotte was one of the first cities in the country to pilot a body cam program. Why? What was the impetus for doing that?
Chief Monroe was at the forefront of the discussions on this technology, and he felt that that was a technology that he wanted to bring to Charlotte. There were other incidents that made him believe that that was something that he wanted to bring to our police department so that they could have the latest and best technology.
Were you on city council at that time?
No, I was not.
I would imagine, because police cameras cost money to buy, whether they're dash cams or whether they're body cams, that has to go through city council or a county commission or the state legislature or all three to get the money necessary to do that. And to do that, it had to be sold to voters as a good idea and worth the money. What was the rationale at the time to spend that money?
More transparency. That the research had shown that cities and jurisdictions that used body cameras had an improvement in the rate of response from police officers.
Rate of response.
Well, the improvement in the response from police officers, okay, regarding incidents, as well as citizens, is also. So when people feel that they are on camera, mm-hmm, sometimes there's a little bit of a different reaction.
I know you don't want to talk specifically about the Keith Smith case, the Keith Scott case, but I have to ask, since you used the word transparency, and the reason for us wanting these cameras in the first place was to bring more transparency, do you think the city dropped the ball on the Keith Scott case by not releasing the videos more quickly?
I think that that's a really difficult issue. I can only speak for myself. I was on the Police Foundation board when we looked at, when we helped to pilot the technology. My concern at the time, having been a victim of crime, was the victims, frankly. And when you're talking about releasing tapes into the public that it could account, and I'm not talking about this issue because we're talking about the transparency involved with releasing this kind of technology. This could be all sorts of different incidents that took place. It could be domestic abuse situations. It could be there could be children in the tapes. There could be footage could be taken in someone's home. footage can be taken of people that die, and that you are releasing information on someone's worst day, somebody's most miserable, vulnerable moment into the public, into the public domain, where people can take that footage, they can put it on YouTube, they can edit it how they want. And so I'm very cautious about that.
But, and I understand all those concerns, but we had riots in the aftermath of that shooting. When does public safety trump private concerns?
Well, I think that, you know, this was a flashpoint in that discussion. This technology is fairly new. Legislation doesn't keep up with technology in all sorts of incidents, cases. And in this particular case, this is something that now gives us more things to think about. Hmm. You know, there wasn't a lot of discussion about it beforehand, and now there is.
Seth Doten, you're a former police officer, and as an officer, you helped create, I'm told, policies to govern the use of these new technologies. How would you have felt as an officer? Maybe you had body cams, but if you didn't, how would you have felt having to use them?
We didn't have body cameras. We did have dash cameras when I was an officer. This was pre the body cam era. I, as an officer, would have been frustrated and slightly disgusted at having to use body cameras. And
Here's why.
Officers think of themselves very much as professionals. They have tremendous authority. They are given a vehicle. They are given weapons. They're given the authority to take life if necessary and liberty. So when you combine all of that with body cameras, the message that officers get is, we aren't trusted. Our management, supervisors, the top brass of the department don't trust us. The community doesn't trust us. And that can be a real morale hit. Now, that's an important perspective, but it's not the only perspective that we need to assess when we're making public policy decisions. That's why officers need to be educated in the same way that we all need to be educated about what the tool, body cameras or dash cameras for that matter, what they do and why we're adopting them. So that would be an initial reaction. And in fact, in agencies around the country that have rolled out body cameras, there has been some initial resistance to body cameras very, very broadly. And typically, within 6 months or a year of the agency using body cameras, officers have changed their position. One general truism is that police officers hate two things more than anything else. They hate the way things are now, and they hate change. And body cameras represent a pretty big change for officers.
Why did they change their minds? Why have officers changed their minds after a year of wearing body cameras?
Because the sky hasn't fallen. Mm-hmm. It hasn't increased the perception among officers that their supervisors and managers are subjecting them to arbitrary discipline. Sergeants and lieutenants aren't reviewing every minute of video to try and catch officers' every mistake. It's reducing complaints against officers, sometimes because officers and civilians are both changing their behavior on camera, sometimes because civilians withdraw complaints once they know an incident is on camera. So, and in addition to all of the behavioral and complaint or disciplinary side of things, officers are also using body cameras as investigative tools.
Let me ask you this. Let me ask you this, because you said initially that police officers felt the institution of body cameras was something that demonstrated a lack of trust by their supervisors of themselves as officers in the field. And you said they were given a lot of power, including the power to take a life if they felt the need arise. What we have seen because of body cameras, and mostly, I think, because of bystander cameras on cell phones, is that there are a lot of bad apples out there, or a lot of people not reacting well to bad situations. Perhaps there needs to be more training. Has the video that has come out in the media of officers in these situations that have caused unrest in so many communities around the country demonstrated to the officers themselves that they need to rethink their behavior in the field?
So I don't want to speak on behalf of all officers, but I'll to the extent that I have to answer that question, I'll give it my best shot. For many, the answer is no. For many, the incidents that they've seen, even egregious shootings like Walter Scott here in South Carolina, are an indication that there are, as you mentioned, bad apples, that there are individual officers who are making bad decisions in particular cases for whatever reason. But that, the response is, generally, that doesn't mean that all officers should be subject to this body camera footage. And I just want to go back historically for just a second to talk about police resistance to change and transparency efforts. In the 70s, officers were very, very reluctant to wear name tags. Not something today that we take for granted, but there was a tremendous controversy at the time over whether officers should wear name tags. If we go back 100 years before that, officers were incredibly reluctant to wear uniforms for some of the same reasons that we're talking about today. So that idea of officer reluctance and the perception that change equals distrust is, I think, an inevitable part of any implementation of new equipment and sometimes new policies.
Nancy Levine is with us from NPR in Washington. She's the director of the Urban Institute at the Urban Institute's Justice Policy Center. A lot of civilians mistakenly believe, Nancy, that body cams and dash cams could act as a panacea, removing all doubt about what actually happens during interactions between police and civilians. Why has this proven not to be the case?
Oh, there's so many reasons, Mike. One that I think is interesting is this issue around, well, we talked about the issue of perspective, right? So the camera's only capturing one perspective, and that is of the officer, and also where the camera is placed on the officer's body. Sometimes they're placed on the shoulder, sometimes the chest, sometimes on their head, their hat or helmet. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that gives a different perspective, and it only shows one side of the story, so to speak. But it's also the case that officers have the discretion to turn cameras on and off, as we've seen quite recently when the public demands for accountability in the form of footage released after high-profile events, and it's discovered that, oh, the camera wasn't turned on for the first, say, 40 seconds. And that, of course, diminishes the transparency that body cameras were designed
to. And how do we know that that's true, that the camera wasn't turned on for the first 40 seconds? Perhaps the first 40 seconds shows something that would put the officer or the police department in a bad light, and so they choose not to release that part of it, and just to use that as an excuse. How do we know?
I doubt that is happening. That would be an agency-wide deliberate falsification of the truth. I don't see that happening. What I think is more likely is that an officer may truly forget, or may, I'm on radio, air quotes, forget, mm-hmm, to turn the camera on under certain circumstances. Another thing that's kind of interesting about the cameras themselves that most people don't know is that for the 30 seconds prior to an officer turning the camera on, the video is going. It's like buffering. You don't get sound, but you do get images. So you can study that and see what precipitated the decision to turn the camera on, particularly when the camera's turned on late. So that's an important piece of investigative information.
And I think we have an example of that in the Keith Scott case here, where the police body camera in one instance only has audio 23 seconds into the what we're seeing, and that's because, mm-hmm, we're looking
that's
at
the buffered video,
mm-hmm, but not the audio. We have to take a break. I'm going to come back more and talk about the what you wrote an article for. You wrote an article in the Washington Post called The Five Myths About Body Cams, and I want to explore that with you, Nancy, when we come back. We're also here with Seth Stoughton, a professor of law at USC School of Law and a former police officer, and Julie Eiselt from Charlotte City Council. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Malak Jewelers, the diamond specialists at the Arboretum, a direct diamond importer dedicated to teaching customers about diamonds and fine jewelry to make an educated decision. MalakJewelers.com. Tomorrow on this program, American companies have used H-1B guest worker visas for decades to bring in foreign-born workers to fill skilled positions for which they could not find American workers. But now the practice is on the rise. In Charlotte, it rose by 39% in a year. Critics say it's a way for employers to find cheaper workers at the expense of American citizens. So we take a closer look at the guest worker program and how it's used here and around the country on this program tomorrow at 9. Tomorrow evening at 7, a special two-hour public conversation, Building Trust in the Aftermath of the Shooting of Keith Scott by Police, that will air live tomorrow night at 7.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, across the country, more than 200 million Americans could be affected by ballot measures up for votes this fall. They address issues like gun control, the minimum wage, and marijuana legalization, key ballot measures, and how citizens are driving many of them.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show following Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Julie Eisel, chair of the Community Safety Committee and a member of the Charlotte City Council. Seth Stoughton is an assistant professor of law at USC's School of Law and a former Tallahassee police officer. And Nancy Levine is director of the Urban Institute's Justice Policy Center. We have just been talking with Nancy about the use of these body cams, which you say are actually the same as stationary public surveillance cameras. They don't show much more. How can that be true when that's a wide angle and the police body cams are action?
Oh, I didn't say it was the same. I think you're referring to the article that I did in the Washington Post. What mm-hmm. I was referring to is that we've learned something from evaluations of stationary public surveillance cameras, or CCTVs as they're commonly known, mm-hmm. and that is that the value of that footage is often compromised by lighting, by visibility associated with weather conditions, by whether it's daytime or nighttime, and these same issues compromise the footage that's obtained through body cameras.
Okay. You have...
If I can cut in and supplement, sure. Nancy's exactly right, and her article is really good. And one more thing that frustrates body cameras is movement. Cameras don't capture movement in a way that our eyes and brains can decode and understand very well. If everyone focuses their eyes on something and then moves their head around, your eyes stay more or less in focus. So right now I'm looking at the door to my office and I'm moving my head all around and it stays more or less in focus. But if I took a video of that and I showed you the video, you wouldn't be able to focus on one thing. It's because your brain accommodates and decodes that movement when it's taking in information through your eyes and transmitting that into your brain.
Well, that's exactly right. And when you have both the camera moving and the subject moving, that becomes even more difficult to discern.
And, of course, the people who don't know about film editing or video shooting and only exposure to that is television and the movies, that you have to understand that the cameras in those situations show you precisely what they want you to see, even though it may be handheld and jerky. The way it's edited and put together is not the way things are shot by a body cam on a police officer. It's just not the same at all. You have an demonstration, Seth, in fact, on the New York Times website of how one might get the wrong impression about what an officer is facing if you take that impression from what you see from his body cam video. How did you come up with the idea to do this?
That's exactly right. So the idea was to come up with a couple of videos that would demonstrate some of the shortcomings of body cameras. They're tools. They can be good tools. But like any tool, they are limited. You can't use a hammer to drive a screw, right? Mm-hmm. So I wanted to get that point across in a way that it would make sense to people. So I came up with some videos that when you see them from one perspective, the body camera perspective, and when you don't have other context, when you're just watching the video, most people come to a particular conclusion about that video, whether they think they see a fight or an officer getting knocked over. And then when you watch a different perspective, you see something entirely different. Same event, just filmed from a slightly different perspective. I use these videos when I train lawyers and judges and police supervisors about how they are interpreting body camera footage. Because not only does it not capture all of the information that it might, as Nancy correctly pointed out, it can also provide a misleading interpretation of a series of events. They not only can be incomplete, they can suggest a completely wrong series of events.
I was given a link to watch this demonstration. Is there an easy way for ordinary people to get to those demonstration videos?
I think it's still up on the New York Times website. If you look for body cameras on New York Times, and of course people can always email me, and I'm happy to provide a whole bunch more videos than the New York Times actually used.
We can put a link up on our website later today, because I think people would find this very valuable and enlightening. You say that body cameras may exacerbate an inherent, inescapable bias. This is one of the things that this demonstration on that website points out. Among the things you say about the use of body camera videos, that when video allows us to look at an incident through the eyes of a person, as body cams do, because allegedly we're seeing something along the lines of what the officer is seeing, we tend to adopt an interpretation that favors the eyes of the person that you're looking at the video through. The other thing you point out is that a person's opinion of the trustworthiness of police prior to viewing the body cam video tends to influence our evaluation of what we see. Talk about that.
Yeah, we see what we expect to see. When we are watching a video, or interpreting any piece of evidence for that matter, we interpret that evidence in a way that confirms our pre-existing notions about the world. So if we think that the police are trustworthy and reliable, then when we see a video that's potentially ambiguous, we're going to interpret it in a way that favors the officers. If we are distrustful of the police when we see a video that is potentially ambiguous, we're going to interpret it in exactly the opposite way. This is how two different people who have two different views, one that's very trusting of the police and one that's very distrusting of the police, can watch the same footage, and they won't just come to different conclusions, whether force was justified or unjustified. They will actually see different facts. One might see the officer getting shoved and reacting defensively, and the other doesn't see that at all. The other sees the officer using force aggressively.
Nancy Levine, have you found that to be the case as well?
I don't have much information on that particularly, but I did want to zero in on something that was referenced earlier by Julie and also by Seth in terms of different perspectives capturing different parts of the story, so to speak. And that is this issue around protecting the privacy of people who are captured on video. And the challenge there is that if law enforcement are going to release footage, they need to take the time to redact, to mask the identity of people captured on the footage. And that can be very time-consuming. You would think that technology could do this, but it is not easily done because of that issue that we were referencing earlier, that both the camera is moving because it's on a moving object, the officer, and often the subject is moving as well. So there's no automated way to redact the facial images and identifying features of people captured on camera. And so you'll see some agencies, like Seattle Police Department, for example, is a great example. In Washington, they have very expansive public records laws, meaning that most anyone can get access to public records, and they consider body-worn camera footage to be public record there. And the way Seattle PD responded to it was to publish their own YouTube channel, which shows all the video, but it's entirely blurred, so not just specific faces, but everything. And you can go and look. It makes me dizzy.
Does that neuter its value for the average person?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So then what's the point of putting it up on a YouTube site?
They're complying with their state law.
Okay. Well, that ties into a question from one of our listeners, Ron, who emails, how do body cams relate to the law that provides someone be read their Miranda rights? Because some of this footage will be taken prior to having those rights read. Is this admissible in a court of law? And I'll add to that, does that prejudice the case before it goes to court?
I'll take a shot at that. So formally, they're entirely separate. Formally, you don't have to be read your rights on camera. In fact, formally, you don't have to be read your rights at all unless you're going to be subjected to what's called custodial interrogation. If police are going to ask you incriminating questions after they arrest you, then you need rights, but otherwise not. But what we're starting to see, what I'm hearing from prosecutors and defense attorneys both, is this idea of a body camera effect, sort of like what's often called the CSI effect, where jurors are expecting forensic evidence or expecting forensic evidence to be clearer than it actually is. Mm-hmm. And I'm starting to hear stories of jurors who are expecting there to be body camera footage of various events, and when there isn't, jurors are drawing presumptions. If there's no footage, maybe that means it didn't happen. Or if there's no footage, maybe it means that it didn't happen in the way that someone is describing, whether that's the officer or the criminal defendant. So the legal system is still struggling to figure out how to address the presumptions that people bring with them, because we tend to incorrectly expect camera footage to be neutral and objective and comprehensive.
You believe in body cams, I'm told, Seth. You say that body cameras can have a positive impact. In San Diego, complaints about officers fell 40.5%, and the use of personal body force by officers dropped by 46.5% after that city adopted body cameras. And according to a study by the Southern California city of Rialto, they showed that department-wide implementation of body cameras decreased police use of force by 65% and resulted in a drop of citizen complaints against police by 88%. This all sounds very good, very positive, isn't it?
It is, but it's a little more mixed than that. There are other studies in Phoenix and in Alberta, Canada, for example, that found no statistical significant impact on use of force, although they did find a decrease in complaints against officers. I am pro-body camera as long as we understand that it is a tool, and it is a limited tool. What makes me fearful, what gets me very worried about body cameras, is the assumption that they are going to, by themselves, solve some deep underlying problems that have really widened, created, or failed to patch this fissure between police and community relations.
Do you know how the facts on how what has happened as a result of body cameras being implemented at CMPD? Do we have similar statistics to the ones I just read from San Diego and Rialto?
I don't know if we have statistics specifically about the number of citizen complaints. I know that that was one of the statistics nationally, the national statistic that was cited when we when Chief Monroe lobbied to have body cams, is that it improved interactions between police and citizens.
And as we've seen in the case of Keith Scott, the release both of the body camera footage and the dash camera footage don't tell the full story of what happened in that incident, not even when you combine it with the bystander video from the widow of Mr. Scott. If you put them all together and edited them in such a way that you'd be doing a television show, you'd still not have a clear picture of what happened. So does that negate the value of these cameras? Does it do what we want with cameras, or does it just increase the distrust of police? Because even with three different sources, we don't know what happened.
I think it's a matter of managing people's expectations. The more we have incidents that we use body cameras, and the more discussion we have about body cameras, it's very important, as Nancy or Seth have mentioned, that we take context into account. So we're not trained, the average person watching this after it's been released, we're not trained to know how officers are able to interact, what their training allows them to do, what was actually taking place at the time, what happens if somebody's got their arms under them or below them, how police can respond. So without any of that context, the average person just isn't really able to discern whether or not what they're seeing was appropriate.
Overall, Nancy, have the use of body cameras been beneficial to the police, to the community at large?
I think on average, the research suggests that they do have their intended impact in improving behavior of both officers and the citizens with whom they interact. But there's another goal of body cameras, and that's transparency. And the transparency goal has fallen very short of being fulfilled, and that's in large part because of different state laws and interpretations of laws around what constitutes a public record, whether video captured from body-worn cameras is indeed public record. And in even that said, each state has a lot of differences in terms of what that means in terms of public release. So it's very, very complicated. I'm happy to discuss that in more detail.
And we're going to talk about that because we have a new law that went into effect on Saturday here.
Yes.
You point out also, Seth, that every jurisdiction has its own policy. L.A. does not release footage. Las Vegas releases footage within 3 days. Shouldn't there be, as a former police officer, shouldn't there be some sort of either nationwide standard, maybe perhaps federally mandated, or some kind of handbook that constitutes best practices when it comes to these things?
There should certainly be some best practices. And I think one of the – we have to remember there are something like 18,000 different police agencies in the country. About 15,000 of them are local, city or county-level police agencies. They all do things a little bit differently, sometimes very differently, and that can be a really good thing because they are the laboratories of experimentation. They are figuring out what works, not just what works in an abstract sense, but what works in their local community. L.A. and Las Vegas are two different places. Two different approaches might both work very well.
Explain why that could be true. Places. Explain to me why that could be true. As a citizen of the United States, why would my rights be different in Las Vegas versus L.A.? I don't understand that.
Well, it's not a matter of rights. It's a matter of state laws, right? So there's each state has different laws about what's public record and what should be released and under what circumstances. So you just chose two jurisdictions from different states. That alone would dictate different rights to access to the footage. But I would argue
but
that
Seth just said what works best for each community may be different. How can that be? Why would that be?
Here in Columbia, South Carolina, the local police agencies might have a very different relationship with the public than in, say, Newark, New Jersey, or Los Angeles. Police agencies, because they're hyper-localized, because we have so many and they are so local, police agencies have to work very, very closely with their local community. And the idea that there is a one-size-fits-all approach to managing police community relations is, I think, often misdirected. In a community like Ferguson, for example, particularly the Ferguson of a couple of summers ago, before the Michael Brown incident brought all of the problems into plain view, there was still a deep distrust and a huge schism between the police and the community. On the other hand, say, Richmond, California, where the police chief, who has now gone to Tucson, where the police chief spent more than half a dozen years focusing on the police community relationship, although Richmond, California was a high crime, high violent crime area, they had a much better relationship with the community than Ferguson as a suburb of St. Louis. So the approach that was necessary and that worked well in Richmond would not necessarily have worked well in Ferguson.
Well, but I would argue that what worked well in Richmond was probably many years of transparency, right? So they had built that trust.
Yes, absolutely. I agree. But you need to take the small steps to get there, and I am generally in favor. I love Las Vegas's approach. Release video within 3 days with an explanation. Make sure that the preliminary investigation, you've interviewed the people you need to interview. You've shown the video to people who need to see it first, like family members.
And let me stop you there because we have to take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk about the new law that went into effect in North Carolina over the weekend. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and TFM Carolina's Sovereign Oaks, building an inclusive Asheville community of home sites centered around nature for backyard farming of chickens and bees. 12 new home sites open October 22nd, sovereignoaks.com. And Mecklenburg Eye Associates, specializing in the treatment of eye disease and personalized routine eye care for over three decades, locations in Charlotte and Rock Hill. Mecklenburg Eye Associates, 800-628-EYES or MECEye. Across the country, more than 200 million Americans could be affected by ballot measures up for votes this fall. They address issues like gun control, minimum wage, and marijuana legalization. Key ballot measures and how citizens are driving many of them, the topic of the conversation coming up on the Diane Rehm Show at 10. Want to join our conversation? You can do so by emailing us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter @CharlotteTalks. We're coming right back.
sports, once you get past the fans and the fervor, are a business. Men's really more than women's.
The thing is that it's no longer like the feel-good thing to like invest in women's sports, you know? Yeah. Now it's actually a smart investment.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Soccer great Abby Wambach talks about leveling the playing field. Next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Julie Iselt, Chair of the Community Safety Committee and a member of Charlotte City Council, Nancy Levine, Director of the Urban Institute's Justice Policy Center, and Seth Stoughton, Assistant Professor of Law at USC School of Law in Columbia. Over the weekend, on October the 1st, Saturday, a new state law went into effect that requires a court order to release dash and body cam footage. Even the police have to seek that court order if they want to release that footage. Julie, you and others have said they will work to have the legislature repeal that law. Why?
I have not said repeal. I have said that I would go to Raleigh and I would agree to ask our legislators to work with us on it. Speaker Moore has said he's been willing to tweak it, and I appreciate that he has said that. I think that that's an opportunity that we have to take him up on.
Nancy, from your experience around the country, do any other states have a law like ours?
Not exactly. I'll tell you what I like about the law. What I like is that there's a ton of transparency for people who are captured on footage to know exactly how they can go about requesting to view that footage. And that's relatively rare. We've, at the Urban Institute, have been tracking all the legislation related to body cameras, in addition to just looking at existing statute and how that might apply to body camera use and release of footage. So that's the good news. The not so good news is that I would argue that North Carolina went a bit too far in not allowing law enforcement agencies the discretion to release footage in the case of high-profile incidents when the public is demanding to see what happens, even if, as we've already discussed, that's only one piece of the story. You know, let the public decide whether it's telling anything of interest. It's just it really inhibits police chiefs, particularly, you know, progressive-minded ones that are very interested in rebuilding or building from the ground up trust between law enforcement and communities, primarily communities of color, where crime tends to be higher and police presence higher as well. The other thing I would add is that we have examples of other states that have also passed body worn specific statutes. And Oklahoma, I think, is an interesting case because of an incident of an officer shooting a gentleman in Tulsa quite recently, and they released the footage right away. And that made me think, oh, let me go back and examine the Oklahoma statute. Well, the way the Oklahoma statute reads is that all video is public record, except if there's a death or nudity or some other things, unless that death is at the hands of an officer.
Hmm. You said that this new law provides greater transparency, and I'm wondering whether it's because it gives people avenues that they didn't have before to get to this footage, or that it simply very clearly spells out the pathway to get that footage.
Yes, it very clearly spells out the pathway. In other states, it's just not clear. And, you know, there's a lot, it leaves a lot to the local law enforcement agency to decide how to interpret the state laws and what they are able to do or not.
Does it also provide ordinary citizens who may be upset by a police shooting a way around politicians and around police departments, which may in fact be political in some cases, and into the judiciary that's allegedly more even-tempered and even-handed?
I think that's right. But I also think that because the public at large can't see videos when they're demanding them, when there are high-profile cases, that transparency only goes so far.
Mm. There's also a big difference in transparency between a police agency voluntarily and on its own discretion releasing a video and even the most progressive police agency being ordered to release that video. If the idea is that body cameras and body camera video should increase transparency and goodwill and trust, then getting a court order no matter how well-meaning that is, getting a court order does not send the same message about a police agency's willingness to be accountable to the public.
It means you had to force them to do it. So what is your take, Julie, on this? As a member of City Council, are these videos public records? Do we, the public, the citizens who bought and paid for the cameras, own the videos and the right to see them?
Well, to some extent, it depends upon what's in the video. If it becomes a personnel issue, then it's not. If it becomes part of a criminal investigation,
define personnel issue, because if a police officer fires his gun, he did something in the line of duty. Whether he did it rightfully or wrongfully is immaterial. It's a personnel issue, isn't it?
Well, I'm just saying that was the consideration before this new law was passed. So I think one of the things that concerns me with the new law is that you have to go to a superior court judge. The average person, that's pretty onerous for the average person to have to go to a superior court judge to get those tapes released. It's more expensive and more time-consuming.
But will the average person have to do it? Won't the Charlotte Observer and the television stations and the radio stations go in there and do it for them?
I don't know.
No, I don't think they're allowed to.
Really, it has to be an individual.
It has to be. The way the statute reads is it has to be the individual or a representative of the individual, which is, I think, typically a family member or an attorney.
One of the arguments against releasing these videos is that they may impact or impede an ongoing investigation. Seth, you're a former police officer and you're a professor of law. How does that work? Why would that be the case?
It can be the case, although that's often political cover or legal cover as a way to not release something that a department may think will make them look bad. But it can be the case in the following way. One, memory is fallible. Human memory can change, either intentionally, as someone provides information they know isn't correct, or as their own – sorry, I'm not saying this very well. Let me try that one again. Let's say that I'm an eyewitness to an officer-involved shooting, and I don't speak to the police then. I go back and I watch a video of that shooting. Now, at that point, I can do one of two things. Intentionally, I could adapt what I tell the police to based on what I saw. I could change my testimony to the police to make sure it fits the video. That's intentional. It also might affect me without me knowing. Unintentionally, it could affect my memory of the event. And that's a problem because then I'm not providing my eyewitness testimony, which already has some reliability issues. I'm providing my eyewitness testimony through the filter of having watched the video. So there are some evidentiary and investigative integrity issues, but I often think they're a little bit overblown. If investigators do what they should be doing, which is to canvass the area and get statements from as many eyewitnesses possible within the hours after a shooting or an incident like that, then there are much, much, much fewer investigative issues. You may have some legal issues, for example, with attorneys wanting to change the venue to move a court case out of the jurisdiction where it happened because everyone there has already seen the body camera footage. But that's not an investigative integrity issue. That's now a judicial process issue.
Right. Nancy, you already mentioned that one of the things that makes these cameras work or not work is the fact that they have to be on and that the officers can control that. And although the video is constantly recording, but you only see the first 23 to 30 seconds of it before you actually push the on button and then the sound kicks in. Is there any way around that? I mean, is there any way around having the officer have control of when they turn their cameras on or off?
Yeah, the technology certainly exists to create any number of mechanisms by which the camera would turn on automatically. So I could imagine the camera turning on when they get a call from dispatch, the camera turning on when their service weapon leaves the holster, the camera turning on based on biometrics. If you can imagine fitting an officer with a Fitbit-like device where you could detect that the pulse starts racing and, oh, maybe they're in a high-stakes situation. The last thing they're thinking about is, let me pause and turn on my camera while I'm chasing someone with a weapon, whatever it is.
Or if you're walking or running and you've been in
exactly.
a cruiser, they could turn it on. Because my phone knows when I'm walking, so certainly the camera could know.
All that that technology exists. It's just a matter of the camera vendors making it an option.
One of the other problems, Julie, in Charlotte with this particular case was the fact that Mr. Scott was sitting in his parked car, and the officers there on the scene at first were undercover officers, and they weren't there for him. They were there to find somebody else, and discovered that he had allegedly had a gun on the seat and allegedly was rolling a marijuana joint. And so they decided to approach him, and when they made that approach, they went back to their cars and got on their police jackets, which say CMPD on them. Why couldn't they have also donned a camera?
Well, those were tactical officers, and at the moment, our tactical officers don't have
body cameras.
It's a budget issue, right? So when we first approved $7 million to outfit our police officers with body cameras, the goal was to put them on our patrol officers first. So that is something that...
How much more would it have cost to put them on everybody?
Well, you can do... So it was about $5.5 million to outfit 1,400 officers. So if you do the math on what that costs, the cameras themselves are not very expensive. Right. They're less than $1,000. The data storage can be five times that.
Right.
We spend over $1 million a year in paying for the licensing for each one of those officers / cameras, because they're assigned to a camera, and the software storage. So, the goal was to get them on patrol officers first. Now CMPD is looking at, and had been looking at, how to get them on tactical officers and how to get them on off-duty officers.
During the protests here, the recent unrest here, the victim's family and others called for both transparency and accountability. And Nancy, you point out that when body cams were rolled out in Denver, their police chief told citizens they should know officers are being held accountable, and that the only officers who would have a problem with body cameras are bad officers. And you say, not so fast. That's not always true. Why not?
Well, in most jurisdictions, the unions have played a pretty big role in guiding policy about when and how body cameras should be deployed. And that includes negotiating that footage can't just be kind of routed through in a fishing expedition by supervisors. So it can't be as a tool to just try to find officers who are not complying with the law or with departmental policy.
NPR's Robert Siegel spoke with Nancy not too long ago on All Things Considered, and he asked if police need to inform those being recorded that they are in fact being recorded. And Nancy, I believe you said that it depends on the state. So, Julie, what's the requirement here?
I don't know the answer to that. If they are by law to have to tell the person in the tape that they are being recorded.
Mm.
I'm pretty sure I can look this up. We have it all online on urban.org, but I'm pretty sure North Carolina is a one-party consent state, meaning that only the person doing the recording needs to know that they're doing the recording.
But would telling a person that you're approaching as a police officer, would telling the person you're going to talk to that you are recording them, could that lead to de-escalation? Because you're being recorded, there's going to be a record of this, so I'll behave better.
That's a very good question, and actually, I think it could go either way. Hmm. You could see how that might make someone more combative. What do you mean you're recording me? Why do you think you should record me? I'm not doing anything wrong.
Hmm.
So I think a lot rests in how that is communicated.
Because you pointed out to Robert Siegel in that conversation that I alluded to a moment ago that designating these videos as public records is important, because then they can only be released through the Freedom of Information Act. I believe this is what you said. And even that puts a burden on police, because they have to make sure that they're not violating the privacy of citizens who are captured on it. But, you know, we're recorded every day by hundreds, maybe thousands of cameras, depending upon which city we're in. If you are photographed on a public street, don't you forfeit the right to privacy? I mean, in the moment you were recorded, you weren't in a private setting. You're on a public street.
Right. As I understand it, and Seth may know better than I do on this one, the introduction of the audio component makes it more personal and less public.
Seth?
But I want to get back to something you said, because this designation of public record is open to a lot of interpretation. And in fact, every state in the union absent New Hampshire, has some kind of an exception for law enforcement that enables them to not comply with a public records request. It's usually something around if it's an ongoing investigation or in the interest of public safety, and sometimes that language is very loose, and so it gives agencies a lot of discretion to withhold information.
We only have 2 minutes left, so Seth, as quickly as you can, your research tells us, or tells you, that body cam footage does not tell the whole story. We've talked about this, but neither does footage shot by those directly involved with the police, because once again, we're seeing things through the eyes of the people photographing the situation. Some say that third-party footage is likely to give the most accurate picture because seeing footage from someone other than people taking part in the conversation makes it less aggressive. Would you agree with that?
It can certainly take the viewer out of the immediate interaction, which can reduce this idea of what I call deceptive intensity. It can provide a more neutral view, but it's important to remember that every video, whether it's a drone flying at 60 feet overhead or a security cam or a body cam or a bystander on a cell phone, every video provides only a limited amount of information about an incident. You need that information plus everything else you can gather before you can understand what actually happened in an incident, whether it's all on camera or partially on camera.
I believe I'm right when I say, Seth, you and Nancy both think that these videos ultimately need to be released. Is that correct?
It is for me, yes.
Yes.
Okay. And Julie, you say that we have some learning to do that will include possible changes in how we approach the use of force and training officers in de-escalation. Could body cameras and the footage they produce lead to that more quickly?
It could, sure. It's all part of the puzzle.
Okay. This is an ongoing conversation I'm sure we'll continue to have in the days ahead. I want to thank Seth Stoughton, Assistant Professor of Law at the University of South Carolina School of Law in Columbia, Nancy Levine, Director of the Urban Institute's Justice Policy Center, who joined us from studios at NPR in Washington, and Julie Eiselt, Chair of the Community Safety Committee and a member of the Charlotte City Council. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you.